it seems to me that their immediate aim is Russia's own safety, which they are attempting to preserve by making themselves stronger and everyone else weaker. And how have they gone about it? I think that most of us have forgotten the very first speech that Molotov made at the San Francisco Conference for the United Nations. He laid it all on the line very frankly. He said that in its effort to find safety and security and peace in the world, Russia would rely on three things in this order. First, the Red Army. Second, friendly border states, as he put it. And third, the United Nations. That speech has been forgotten. It should have been taken for the serious warning that it was, because they have proceeded rather exactly in that order of priorities. They did not disarm when we did. They commandeered the whole strip of Eastern European nations lying near their borders. They aided the Chinese communists battle to control all China. They attempted to clear our salient of Berlin by blockade. They attempted to undercut Turkey and the Mideast by winning control of the salient represented by Greece through subversion and guerrilla warfare. And they attempted to clear the salient cutting off their two chief Pacific bases of Vladivostok and Port Arthur by creating a phony civil war in Korea. That, I think, among probably many reasons, certainly was perhaps the most basic reason for the Korean War. As to Communist China, we have no choice but to avoid serious trouble with her, for military involvement in the Great Swamp of China would be a disaster for our whole world position. But certain basic facts of the situation favor us in the long run if we and the Chinese leaders keep our tempers cool and our powder dry. The great fact is this, that there is nothing really that we want from China, and there is much that Russia wants. In other words, there are many points of potential friction with Russia, in Manchuria, in certain ports, along certain railroads, in Xinjiang province, for example. There is probably very little that Russia can give China in terms of trade. There is an immense amount that we can give her in those terms, things she will desperately need, particularly for her great coastal cities, now semi-moribund. Mao Zedong is certainly not another Tito, but over the years, these basic conditions, having nothing to do with ideology, must surely come into play. In any case, that is what your government has been counting on. It has had no other choice, really, and that is why it has hoped, if present passion should ever cool, that the Chinese Red leaders would be in the United Nations to hasten by personal contact, by their personal acquaintance with America, to hasten the day when they might acknowledge our mutual compatibility. That day will never come, of course. The Chinese Reds try to forward the general communist movement with aggressive expansion efforts beyond China's borders in Indochina or Korea or Malaya. And I will ask you again to remember, these are words written 2 or 3 weeks ago, which I am giving for purposes, as I said, of contrast. But China has never been militarily expansionist in that way in her long history. And the present communist leaders of China, for the most part, are not Moscow-nurtured hothouse plants like the Red leaders in Eastern Europe. They are Chinese first and foremost. They made their own revolution through 25 years of bitter sacrifice, and they are today beset by enormous internal problems. That, I think, is a pretty good summary of the thinking in Washington by very responsible people. As to the long-range position with China, up until the last few days. And now we come to the matter that concerns each of us directly and immediately. The domestic corollary to all these vast, complicated, risky, but unavoidable processes of policy in the distant regions of the world. The arduous process of mobilizing and holding our own economic powers, our social unity, our intellectual understanding, and our moral faith through the unpredictable years ahead. This is hard to make clear, just as it is more difficult for a man to understand his own self than the selves around him. It is harder for the American people to understand their national problems than many of the problems they see abroad. Our country is beginning to mobilize its physical strength on the last-ditch hypothesis that if we are very strong, we may never have to use that strength in war. No one can prove that this hypothesis will turn out to be right, but events have amply proved that continued weakness has tended to bring war closer and closer. And so we will make ourselves strong. That is no great problem. We know how to do that, and the country will support the effort, stand the expense, and the sacrifice. We also know how to use that strength if worst comes to worst. But this time, the situation is not like that of 10 years ago. Then the fight was already on, and we knew we were mobilizing to use our strength, all of it. The moral problem was far, far easier. For this time, we may never use it. We hope we will not. Or we may not use it for a good many years. And therein lies the enormous domestic problem, one such as we have never quite faced. Let me put it this way. A boxer will stand the grueling, boring, and weary weeks of training because he knows he will use it, have the fight, and be done with it. Can a free people go through years and years of training, that is, military conscription, extreme taxation, shortages, disruption of schooling, personal plans postponed, endless anxiety, without eventually doing one of two equally tragic things? Breaking training, that is, going soft again, or precipitating the war in order to put an end to an unbearable strain? That has seemed to be the real problem, the heart and the test of this so-called Cold War. And it has been that has been bringing nightmares to many leaders in Washington who do know their history and their people pretty well. For that kind of test is utterly new for us, and it happens to strike at the weakest link in the American armor, which is our patience. Of all the world's peoples, we are the most impatient. And unfortunately, by the testimony of many perceptive writers and much history, the Russians are the most patient. So I can see no chance of avoiding worldwide political defeat or cataclysmic war itself unless the American people, you and I, can meet that challenge. And all our policies all over the world are predicated on the belief that we must and we can. That is what I had written 2 to 3 weeks ago, to say here tonight. I think that the analysis is still largely valid. I think the analysis of Russian intention is still valid. The conclusions as to the relative importance to us and the world of Asia and Europe, I think, are still correct. And I even think those remarks about the long-term course of Chinese-Russian relations are correct, because geography doesn't change. But what is wrong about all the foregoing? Not all of it, I shouldn't say, but what is wrong about certain parts of it? And that did, I think, pretty well represent the best thinking of the best people in our government up to a very short time ago. What is wrong, I think, is a grave miscalculation about the element of time, a miscalculation in degree so great as to amount, perhaps, to a miscalculation in principle. The time measurement has telescoped upon us very suddenly, and to a great extent, we brought that about by our own actions. As it now looks, we threw time away by forcing a test in Korea in order to uphold the moral and political principle of collective security, which can be upheld in a real test only by preponderant strength, And we did this before time had provided that strength. And furthermore, if we were right about the long run between Russia and China, we were wrong in not realizing that their short-run identity of interest would be used by them to the hilt so that each would be strengthened to meet the long run. That they would do that simply by driving out of Asia all other forces which threatened to cause friction and distraction to them in the future. Their short-run partnership had an unrepeatable opportunity, as it now appears to us, to jointly clear Asia of all forces that might have handicapped either of them in the future. The Russians could use the Chinese to clear the Korean salient of their mortal American enemies, and at the same time throw the whole Western alliance off its military base. The Chinese could use the chance to achieve the enormous prestige in Asia of an Asiatic victory over Occidental forces, and in the doing, establish great forces of her own in Manchuria, her most sensitive region, as a counterbalance not only against the West or a future strong Japan or the two in combination, but perhaps also against the Russian power already there. But behind that, I think there is this tremendous historic force which has been in motion. And its aim is not only prestige on the part of the Chinese, its aim is a realization of that bitter dream which has resided in all Asiatic hearts for a century or more, a dream of ridding Asia, all of it forever, of Western power. That has been the dream of Nehru and Chiang Kai-shek, as well as of Mao Zedong. And I suppose they have reasoned, these Chinese leaders, that this is the great moment for Asia in that sense. That the head of steam built up through generations was now to be exploded. And the Chinese Reds, as we undoubtedly should have known they would do, have touched the match to it. I think they will do their best to get Formosa, drive the British from Hong Kong and Malaya, French from Indochina, and perhaps ourselves from Japan and the Philippines. I don't think any longer there can be much doubt about it. And one thing that tends to erase the doubts was that perfectly extraordinary speech at the United Nations by the Chinese Communist delegate, General Wu. I think that's probably a document that'll be read in the history books. There are history books generations from now. In that speech, he really made a blood challenge to the West. In that speech, China proclaimed a kind of a Monroe Doctrine over all of Asia. That speech revealed that China, Communist China, sees herself as the shield of Asia, as we saw ourselves as the shield of the Western Hemisphere. And of course, the terrible implication of that speech, and combined with their tremendous strike in Korea now, is that it may be conceived as part of a common plan with Russia, a common war plan, the first great battle of World War III. And the implication of that would be that Russia has renounced all thought of coexistence, even for a few years to come, and has decided to break the West now before all our slow and long-term policies that we've been going on, that I've tried to describe to you, could take effect. They have